comes the Indie Week. For our blind and print-impaired listeners, John Federson is reading the Indie Week issue for June the 24th, 2020. And we gave a bit more time to our visiting musicians today, all the way up from Fort Mudge, Georgia. They are the Okefenokee Glee, Purlieu, and Fire Society Marching Band. And off they go. We'll see them later. And from the Indie Week, this week happens to be the issue presenting the Best of the Triangle readers' survey responses of all kinds of categories. It looks like chiefly food, beverages, entertainment, and the like. And if and as there is any time available to sandwich a few of those awards in, I will plunge ahead with that in between some stories or maybe at the end of the broadcast. Best of the Triangle. However, we go on to our first issue from our first article. Alexis Pauline Gums is the author of Dub, Finding Ceremony, and Freedom Dreams, The Nightmare of Policing is her article. Harriet Tubman had a dream. The whole next day she celebrated that dream and what she saw in it, which was freedom of her people. "My people are free," she proclaimed in the present tense. But all around her was the nightmare of slavery, and not only in the states where chattel slavery was still a legal practice, but in the nationwide Fugitive Slave Act, a policy that some would say has never gone out of practice, a policy by which any black person could be detained, interrogated, stopped, frisked, held against their will, and punished for resisting, a policy that further weaponized whiteness and gave any white person reasonable cause to handle, mishandle, report, suspect black life in general, anywhere, doing anything. Yes, even at home. Yes, even asleep. Bird watching? Sure. This is the part of the context of the nightmare that black people have been living with or dying under for centuries, and that it is harder for non-black people to ignore in the time of cell phone camera documentation. But Harriet Tubman had a dream, and that dream put her to work. She went to South Carolina and organized for a year to get the intelligence and the community support of over 750 enslaved Africans on rice plantations who would free themselves and each other on June the 2nd, 1863, at the Combahee River. It was a military attack that shifted the position of the Union Army in the Civil War. It was an economic attack that targeted the rice plantations that were bankrolling the Confederacy. It was concerted collective action on behalf of the possible in the midst of a nightmare. Assata Shakur's grandmother had a dream, too. In the dream, she saw her granddaughter's freedom. And while the state was completely clear that no person who had been a member of an organization that put the words black and liberation and army together could be allowed to continue their work, Assata Shakur's grandmother was right. A community of people took major risks to free Assata from prison and get her to Cuba, where she continues her purposeful and inspiring work to this day. In the midst of a nightmare during which the police shot, tortured, confined, and defamed Assata, her grandmother's freedom dream is what actually determined the future. So, what does this have to do with us, Durham? Are we in the midst of a dream or a nightmare? What can these historical dreamers teach us beyond the co-optation of Martin Luther King's dream speech, which has been misused to portray a myth of liberal equality while the nightmare rages on? The dream has everything to do with the dreamer. Psychoanalysts say that the meaning of a dream is determined by the symbolic worldview of the person dreaming. And maybe what we are realizing now is that all dreams are not created equal, or more precisely, not created to make us equal. Because as Fred Moten taught me, the dreams of the settler become policy, which means they become police. In Durham, we could translate that to say, the dreams of developers become city mandates. Who do you imagine sleeps well at night in a context of unaffordable housing and rampantly rising evictions? Who sleeps well with the incessant sound of construction work, exempt even from Durham's citywide stay-at-home order during the first month of the recognized pandemic? What is the equity of dream real estate when developers consider an investment in police a necessary element of convincing elite residents that Durham is a safe place for them to lay their heads, while black residents are dealing with the trauma of knowing police get away with coming into black people's homes and murdering them while they sleep? And the city council is complicit in how the dreams of developers have already become policy in Durham, as especially evidenced by the recent decision to increase the police budget and lower the human resources budget in this moment of all moments. Maybe the dreams of Harriet Tubman's and Assata Shakur's grandmother had nothing to do with equality. Maybe they were about calling a nightmare, and aligning our action toward the possibility of freedom, and we need them right now, because the dreams of our revolutionary ancestors are intergenerational, too. The dreams of revolutionaries birth revolutions, and these dreams are alive here in Durham. I am grateful for the persistent work of Durham Beyond Policing to dream and practice a world beyond captivity, and I challenge my fellow Durham residents to conduct an ethical sleep study right now. Is it time for you to continue to work toward your dream, or is it time to wake up? And next, our 15 minutes column this week interviews Michael Rashad Galloway. He's a UNC Chapel Hill alumnus and founder of the MRG Consulting Agency. What pushed you to petition the lift to lift the UNC Board of Trustees moratorium on renaming campus buildings? It kind of started back when I was on campus with Silent Sam, just seeing how hard people of color on campus, specifically African Americans, were working to get that changed after the Saunders Hall incident. That was kind of the start of my interest in history and knowing what was going on at my university and what these symbols and different names on these buildings stood for. Fast forward to more recently. I was doing some research on my hometown, which was named after Reuben Reed, who was a huge slave owner. He owned a 700-acre plantation that encompassed some of Reedsville. I was doing research and came to realize my town is named after him. His son was also a segregationist, a Southern rights advocate, and was part of every level of government, from local all the way up to federal. He served as a governor. He was a slave owner. He believed in Southern rights, and it just made me realize this is what we come from. This is what our cities are built off of. A lot of times we don't know because we're educated by the people around us, and it comes to a point where it's like, man, do they even want us to really know what's going on? Question. The petition seemed to gain traction really quickly. How did that happen? I just posted it on all three of my pages, and on Instagram, people just started liking it, sharing it. Excuse me. The post had more shares than it had actual likes. I realized people were latching on to those same demands, and they wanted to see the same change that I did. I actually had several people start reaching out to me, ranging from athletes like James Michael McAdoo to old UNC alumni, some going back as late as the 90s. I had the pleasure to talk to a former trustee, Mr. William Keyes, about certain things that were going on as well. From there, people just started spreading the word, and it started getting a lot of traction. I actually had no actionable steps, per se, when I put the Facebook post up. But from that, people kept asking me, what's the petition? What can we do? Where's the protest? And I was like, man, I hadn't thought that far. Basically, due to the time and circumstance, I think a protest would be good, but just starting to petition first and getting that out there will start to give a picture of the change the UNC community wants to see. And the final question, the petition still has two action items to address, recontextualizing Keenan Stadium, named after one of the leaders of the Wilmington Massacre, and renaming buildings with ties to white supremacy and slave ownerships. What are the next steps for you? I think the first step is just to continue to push the petition. I say we need to be in contact with our university, letting university officials know that this is not how we want things to be, staying in contact with them. Specifically, for me, I've been in contact with a lot of staff and faculty at UNC who don't align with the way the Board of Trustees thinks. A lot of African-American faculty specifically saw what the Board of Trustees was doing as a huge issue and really not respecting them. As university officials, you have to respect the people we asked to come here and that we hire. And now over to The Good, the Bad, and the Awful, a fairly recent addition to the new format of the Indie Week. Good. Confederate statues gone. After years of waiting on bureaucracy's slow crawl to greenlight the removal of half a dozen Confederate monuments from the state capitol, protesters took matters into their own hands Friday night, ripping two soldiers from the statue facing Hillsborough Street. One metal soldier was left hanging by a rope by the Harget Street signpost, while another was abandoned in front of the Wake County Courthouse. The next morning, Governor Roy Cooper ordered the removal of remaining monuments, including memorials commemorating the women of the Confederacy and Henry Lawson Wyatt. After plucking the final soldier from his pedestal with a crane on Sunday, crews struggled to figure out how to take down the remainder of the 75-foot obelisk without damaging it for the next 2 days. Let us know when it's time for the wrecking ball. And the award, bad. No phase three yet. North Carolina was initially set to move into phase three of the state's tiered reopening Friday, but that's probably not going to happen, given recent spikes in coronavirus cases and hospitalizations. We thought we had mostly flattened the curve, but Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Mandy Cohen admitted Monday that, quote, key metrics are moving in the wrong direction. Cases have been on the rise since the stay-at-home order lifted in May and restaurants were allowed to reopen at limited capacity. Hospitalizations, which had previously leveled at about 500, peaked at 915 patients as of Tuesday and more than 900 ventilators in use. Luckily, we have another 2,000 on hand. If trends continue, a report from UNC claims we only have about 7 weeks before hospitals are overwhelmed. Meanwhile, Republicans continue to push for bars and gyms to reopen and think Cooper, quote, should stop his secret reopening process. And finally, the award for awful, Raleigh Police Department. After weeks of peaceful protest, Raleigh police arrested a 17-year-old black protester claiming she had tried to assault a police officer. But a viral video of the arrest didn't show the alleged assault. Instead, it showed a police officer grabbing the girl by the arm and dragging her across the pavement. As she was handcuffed and arrested, other protesters around shouted at the cop, "She's 17!" An adult protester was also arrested. The next morning, the charges were dropped. Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown, who is usually defensive of officers' conduct, said she would be launching an internal investigation of the incident after seeing concerning footage from the officer's body camera. She's also petitioning the courts to release the footage so we can see for ourselves what led to the teen's arrest. And more or less a continuation now of regional reports, Lee Taus's column from Raleigh, All Fall Down. Forcibly or voluntarily, Raleigh's Confederate monuments were evicted from Capitol grounds this weekend, though one stubborn obelisk remained. The Confederacy existed for only 4 years, but its stain on North Carolina's Capitol grounds endured much longer. In 1895, Democrat and Civil War veteran Octavius Koch spearheaded a project to cement the South's loss with a sense of participation trophies, the crown jewel of which was a statue of a Confederate soldier clutching a gun atop a 75-foot pedestal. The granite monument, adorned with infantry and cavalry soldiers and surrounded by two massive stone cannons, cost $22,000 at the time, nearly $700,000 in today's dollars, adjusted for inflation. It stood for 31 times longer than the Confederacy did, casting its shadow from the Jim Crow era through the civil rights movement, the To Our Confederate Dead monument loomed over Hillsborough Street, taller than the old State House itself. Its message, twofold. For the whites, who looked at the South's treasonous insurrection with a mythologized mix of affection, pride, and heritage, it was a welcome sign. For people of color, it may as well have read whites only, until this weekend. Anti-racist protesters took back the Capitol Friday night, toppling two of the monument's metal soldiers from their posts before dragging them through the streets of downtown. One was hung by the neck from the Harget Street sign. The other was abandoned in front of the Wake County Courthouse, still clutching its cannon rammer. The destruction came after weeks of Black Lives Matter protests calling for justice on behalf of George Floyd, a black man the world watched suffocate to death for 9 minutes under the knee of a white Minneapolis police officer in a viral video. During the first weekend of protests, Raleigh police hurled tear gas and shot non-lethal bullets at the demonstrators, igniting a riot that resulted in widespread vandalism downtown. Shards of glass are still nestled in the cracks of the pavement from the dozens upon dozens of windows smashed that night as rioters looted businesses and set fires. The violence was short-lived. For the last few weeks, the protests had been nothing but peaceful, but on Thursday night, Raleigh police were filmed dragging a black teenager on the ground while arresting her, claiming she had assaulted an officer. The next day, those charges were dropped, and Police Chief Cassandra Deck Brown called for an internal review of the incident after reviewing concerning footage from the officer's body cameras. But the girl's violent arrest on the eve of Juneteenth triggered something in the protesters. Friday night's demonstration began, like many others, with a standoff between Raleigh police officers, who had formed a human shield around the Hillsborough Street Confederate Monument, and several hundred protesters clutching handwritten signs, their faces covered in masks to guard against the invisible threat of coronavirus. Earlier in the day, the protesters had managed to get two ropes around the soldiers, but the cops sliced them away. Yet the energy this time was different. The protesters were not standing down or marching away. Then, without warning, the cops abruptly retreated, allowing protesters to climb the monument as sunset approached. An hour later, two more ropes were slung around the soldiers flanking the base. When the protesters grabbed hold of the rope, pulling in unison, the first soldier popped off his post and plummeted headfirst to the stone steps below, bouncing once before landing in a bush to the joyous screams of the crowd. The cops were nowhere to be seen. The protesters repeated their success with the second low-hanging soldier. After they paraded the metal men victoriously through the streets, a torrential rain soaked downtown, and the crowds dispersed peacefully. Saturday morning, Governor Roy Cooper ordered the rest of the Confederate memorials removed from Capitol grounds, something he'd been fighting to do unsuccessfully in court since taking office, battling a partisan 2015 law, making it all but impossible to relocate the shrine. Quote, "Monuments to white supremacy don't belong in places of allegiance, and it's past time these painful memorials be moved in a legal, safe way," Cooper said in a statement Saturday. Republicans, of course, were outraged by the removals and will likely be duking things out in court. House Speaker Tim Moore lambasted Cooper for ordering the police to stand down while a lawless mob destroyed state property. Moore said Governor Cooper used that failure to justify removing the statues unilaterally instead of following the process laid out in state law. Remarkably, Governor Cooper's actions came just one day after he blocked legislation providing a lifeline to struggling families across North Carolina. Not only is Governor Cooper failing our small businesses, but he's failing to uphold his constitutional duty to execute the law. On Saturday, work crews carefully unbolted two statues, one commemorating Henry Lawson Wyatt and another honoring the women of the Confederacy, from their stone bases and loaded them onto flatbeds. The next morning, crews took aim at the last Confederate soldier resting high atop the pillar, ending its 125-year-old reign. A flatbed truck and crane parked in front of the monument, still covered in BLM spray paint, as police roped off the intersection with caution tape. As the crane began to lift its neck up the left length of the pedestal, two powerful black voices burst out in song. Actress Carly Jones and cellist Shauna Tucker had arrived early to watch the statue come down. They belted out their own rendition of We Shall Overcome. Jones's voice soaring amid the quiet street and the routine beeps of construction equipment. "The statues will come down today," Jones sang. And she said later that morning, "I felt my ancestors present. I really wish my granddad, who would gather us around and lead us in singing the Black National Anthem, I really wish he could be there to see this. My great-grandparents, I wish they could see this. I just feel like this is long overdue." Tucker added, "This is the first time Raleigh has felt truly like my home. I feel like this is a genuine effort for everyone to see that collectively, the city, state, this country, is for the first time in my lifetime, actively and authentically moving forward together." Two workers rode an industrial lift up to the feet of the last metal soldier, unbolting him from the pedestal before looping rope around his body and attaching him to the crane. Gently, the crane plucked the soldier up from his perch as a small crowd of onlookers cheered. Suspended in air, the soldier slowly floated down to the waiting arms of work crews below, who carefully placed the metal man face up on the flatbed truck. Over the next 4 hours, two enormous hunks of granite pillar were removed by the crane, and only the longest, smoothest stretch of the obelisk remained. The heavy granite proved a challenge to unmount. Crews labored around the pillar until after sunset, drilling into it and trying to gently yank it from the base. At one point, crowds reported a loud crack from the pillar, which appeared to stand partly crooked after. Workers returned at 2 a.m. Monday to toil once more at the base. Ropes were attached to the pillar, holes were drilled, but by sunset the granite husk still stood. On Tuesday, as the Indy went to print, workers returned to finish the job. Sunrise exploded cotton candy hues across the sky behind the old Capitol. The soldier was gone, leaving only his stubborn throne. Dynamite or a wrecking ball might have gotten the job done quicker, but state officials are determined to remove the monument unscathed, hoping to protect a time capsule buried within the base containing Confederate relics and items from General Robert E. Lee. Smashing may have been faster and more satisfying, but progress is rarely so. And over to Durham, Tomasi McDonald's More Questions Than Answered. The family of Jamari Bompas, a Durham 18-year-old alleged to have died from a self-inflicted gunshot during a traffic stop, are continuing to fight for answers. The lawyer representing the Bompas family filed a motion last week in Durham's County Superior Court requesting that Durham County Sheriff's Office be ordered to produce the entire investigative file related to the fatal shooting. The slain teen's mother, Hermina Bompas, just wants to know what happened to her son, according to a motion filed last week by attorney Alan Sharp. The family wants to know, if Bompas' death was a suicide, why is it part of an ongoing investigation? The 16-page court affidavit was filed on Friday, 8 days after Hermina Bompas accused Deputy Anthony Sharp, who has since been promoted to corporal, of inventing material facts about the teen's death and that he possibly tampered with his in-car camera system. The lawsuit demands the department release the testing, inspection, and complete in-car recording system, including all wiring from the patrol car driven by Deputy Sharp, along with the gun and bullets found in the Chevrolet Impala Jamari Bompas was driving the night he died. The sheriff's office, quote, appears to have presumed the veracity of Deputy Anthony Sharp's account, and that the sheriff's investigation of the fatal shooting, quote, appears to have only sought and to continue to seek support for that account, the motion states. The court motion details evidence contradicting the police officer's account of what happened during the traffic stop, and according to the sheriff's office, at about 12:39 a.m. on December 15th, Deputy Sharp reported Jamari Bompas pulled out a handgun and shot himself in the head following a traffic stop on Merriweather Drive for what appeared to be fictitious tags. Deputy Sharp claims as he was getting out of his patrol car, he heard a gunshot and saw the driver's side window of Bumpus's sedan shatter. The car then rolled forward about 50 yards before it crashed into a light pole and overturned on its side, according to the incident report. Deputy Sharp waited for backup before he approached the overturned car, where he claimed he found Bumpus unresponsive with a 9mm Glock between his legs and that the weapon was, quote, expelling smoke as if it had just been fired. But the June 18 motion states that the deputy and trainee waited 5 minutes for backup to arrive before approaching the overturned Impala. It also cites a report from EMS paramedics who were told by the deputies that, quote, a gunshot was heard from the vehicle after it crashed. A firearms expert noted that a semi-automatic Glock handgun fired once would only produce a wisp of smoke and probably for no longer than 5 seconds, contradicting Sharp's version of events. Additionally, gunshot residue swabs taken from Deputy Sharp and a trainee, Robert Osborne, were, quote, inconclusive as to whether either had fired a gun. Bumpus's attorney adds that recordings of the family has received show Osborne leaving the scene for a time, quote, apparently before the gunshot residue swab of his hands was done. While, quote, gunshot residue swabs from Jamari's hands have not been tested. The dash camera on Deputy Sharp's patrol car was reportedly not operating at the time of the crash and fatal shooting. Further, camera wiring may have been tampered with. Bumpus' attorney claims, describing the electrical tape covering the wires as, quote, unusual and very problematic. Keisha Lovelace, Burkhead's legal advisor, claimed the electrical tape had been used to cover the wiring during a repair by Piedmont Communications Company, which the company later denied. The Bumpus family also speculated that the car's camera system may have been recorded over, which the sheriff's office denies. During the June 3rd hearing, Senior Resident Superior Court Judge Orlando Hudson ordered the sheriff's office to produce, quote, all camera recordings for Deputy Sharp's vehicle and all other responding vehicles. But the department claimed there are no such recordings to produce. In the court motion, the Bumpus family attorney pointed out that Deputy Sharp and other deputies' actions violate the department's own written policies, which require the use of dash cams for all traffic stops, pursuits, and emergency responses, and the uploading of all recordings before a deputy's shift ends. The orders also prohibit sheriff's employees from attempting, quote, to erase, alter, or tamper with the dash camera systems or recordings. Hermina Bumpus says her son was not depressed, nor did he have a history of depression. The family says the teen was engaged with his family and community and had plans to attend Durham Tech, earn an associate's degree, and transfer to UNC Chapel Hill. He did not have a criminal record. After graduating from Hillside High in 2018, he was working at FedEx and had applied for financial aid to help pay for college, his family says. Down to the very last minute, his was not a life on track for suicide, his family believes. Just after midnight on the night of his death, Bumpus had texted his 21-year-old sister. 14 minutes later, he texted her that he was at McDonald's looking for something to do. She asked for a ride home from Star Bar in Raleigh and said he was coming to pick her up. Those might have been his last words. At 12:36 a.m., one of their cousins texted, "Y'all about to turn TF up." He never responded. 3 minutes later, Deputy Sharp pulled him over. Jamari's Bumpus' death has been ruled a suicide, but attorney Alan Sharp, like the teen's family, is skeptical. "I don't believe Jamari shot himself, either intentionally or by accident," she told the Indy. "Whatever happened to Jamari, the not-at-all-transparent response and lack of investigation by the sheriff's office suggests to me that, at a minimum, they're afraid of what might have happened." And the Durham County Sheriff's Office declined to comment. And now Vernetta Alston writes an op-ed called Sword of Progress. In a landmark decision on June 15th, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it is a violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 for employers to discriminate on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. This may seem like a common sense ruling, but it's bigger than that. For the first time in our nation's history, LGBTQ people have basic protections from discrimination in the workplace. Bostock versus Clayton County provides a historic interpretation of sex discrimination under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. In this instance, the centerpiece of human rights protection in the United States was properly used as a sword, offering overdue protections to all LGBTQ workers. The act itself, a product of the civil rights movement and a growing progressive conscience in the 1960s, is not perfect. Its basic charge, to prevent discrimination on the basis of race, color, religion, sex, or national origin, has been elusive because its protections have been twisted by politics of intolerance and prejudice over its 50-plus year history. In that time, the sword has pointed in the opposite direction of progress, resulting in public establishments becoming private to avoid serving black people, and more recent lower court decisions validating racially biased admissions practices. Despite the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, racism is still present in every corner of our country. It kills black people like Tony McDade and George Floyd. Tony McDade was a black trans man shot to death inexplicably after following commands to stop. George Floyd was a black father whose life was stolen from him under the knee of a police officer on a curb outside a corner store. These were individuals who, in these moments, experienced the kind of personal isolation that comes with being targeted by racist hatred with no hope of institutional support. Like the Civil Rights Act, Bostock will not fix everything. The workplace harassment that affects 40% of working-age LGBTQ people will not go away overnight. The high percentage of transgender people facing unemployment in the best economic times will still confront bias from employers. LGBTQ folks continue to lack health care safeguards, especially after the Trump administration rolled back explicit transgender health care protections. We still lack adequate protection in public accommodations, an issue North Carolina has been center stage on for the wrong reasons. For example, HB2, HB142, NDO prohibitions, and billions in lost economic impact. But the Bostock case gives us hope because it validated Mr. Bostock, a county employee who was outed and fired because he was gay, and the experience of every LGBTQ worker who has experienced workplace discrimination. The result in this case will transform workplace expectations for tens of millions of LGBTQ workers. While that happens, let's use the Civil Rights Act of 1964 as a sword to root out discrimination and racial bias so that workplaces, schools, and corner stores can be safe for all black people in this country. We cannot rely solely on our laws to do it. We need you to validate the experiences of black people. Hold the people in your life accountable for racial bias. Protest centuries of abuse and apathy that contributed to George Floyd's death, and fight for real reform so we feel less alone and safe. All right, we will move to some subject matter related articles. From Food and Drink is the first, and Snapback. For the second year since the park's redevelopment, the Moore Square Market returned to downtown Raleigh, by Leah Taus. Shua Hare fluffs a vibrant bouquet of dazzling zinnias, lilies, and dahlias from a tent propped up on Martin Street in Moore Square. It's cool for June after a week of relentless rain. And it's the first time in a while that pedestrians have casually walked the streets downtown. Coronavirus brought business to a screeching halt in March, followed by weeks of protests over racist policing. The windows of shops downtown remained boarded up from the riots that resulted in widespread vandalism, offering little by way of commerce in the usually bustling downtown. After weeks of sheltering indoors due to the pandemic, Shua Hare is glad to be out on the streets, greeting customers again. After moving to the Triangle from Chicago, she opened up Shumi's Flower in Apex to bring her love of floral arrangements to life. "I am very happy," Hare tells me, as she wraps the bouquet in paper. It means a lot to me because I know I'll be bringing joy to people's homes and offices, people who can't really leave the city. Herr was just one of about 17 vendors, selling everything from soap to legumes, that kicked off the launch of Moore Square Market's second year Wednesday. To ensure safety, hand sanitizer stations were installed and tents were spaced about a dozen feet apart, said David Moore, placemaking and activities manager for the Downtown Raleigh Alliance. He said, "It's bringing some liveliness back to downtown. We have to get back to a place where we can provide some of these activities in the safest way possible. You don't want your community to be dead forever." This year, the program is partnering with the federal SNAP program to allow food stamp recipients to double up on fresh produce. The program matches each SNAP benefit with an additional $10 worth of fruits or vegetables, a much-needed resource for low-income families living and working downtown, with limited access to fresh food. Participating in the program is Nanui's Farms, which specializes in hydroponic lettuce. Owner Trevor Spear said his Raleigh farm is reimbursed for the extra lettuce they give away to SNAP customers. He says, "I'm happy they're getting fresh produce because you worry when they're in that situation what quality food they're eating." Nearby, Janetta West was mixing up a batch of her aptly named OMG Banana Pudding. "I'm telling you," West says, her eyes grinning above the face mask, "the first thing people say when they put it in their mouths is, 'Oh my God!'" More than 25 small businesses will be showcasing their local products in the park through the fall. The market runs every Wednesday from 3 to 6 p.m., through October 21st. For more information, visit downtownraleigh.org/farmersmarket. And here's a sidebar, a week of farmers markets. It suggests you make sure to look up each market before visiting for hours and COVID-19 guidelines. The State Farmers Market, big one downtown, is open daily. Moore Square Market on Blunt Street in Raleigh, Wednesday, June 24th. Saturday, June 27th, Carborough Farmers Market, Chapel Hill, South Durham Farmers Market, Durham Farmers, Midtown Farmers Market in Raleigh, and the Saturday Market at Rebus Works in Raleigh, all are shown as the opening. The Black Farmers Market on Rock Quarry Road in Raleigh is listed for a Sunday, June 28th opening. And again, check those markets if you plan to visit. Now over to the music, and Keisha Jennings writes a column about Pierce Freelon, famous name in music, North Carolina, father of wisdom. Describing Durham native Pierce Freelon as a Renaissance man would be an understatement. Freelon is a former Durham mayoral and NC State Senate candidate, the founder of Black Space, a musician, professor, director, political organizer and Emmy-winning producer, a loving husband, and devoted father of two. On July 31, Freelon will release D.A.D., his first, quote, family album, which chronicles, quote, the life and times of a Black millennial father living in the South. But first, on June the 17th, just in time for Father's Day, he dropped Daddy Daughter Day, the first single from the album, which features Jay Gunn. The idea for the project came together almost 10 years ago when Freelon began to use the Voice Memo app on his iPhone to archive special moments with his two children, Justice and Stella. He says, "They're kind of like vignettes into my life as a parent, but very much in the spirit of what a sample is. It's a piece of music you can build upon to create something new." A self-described family archivist, Freelon says he has, at minimum, 500 voice notes capturing memorable moments. Daddy Daughter Day features fellow Durham MC and community advocate Joshua Gunn. The music video was directed and edited by Ned Phillips of Green Hero Films and features both of the artist's daughters, Stella and Harlem Rose. The song and video challenge pervasive The song and video challenge pervasive yet inaccurate myths about Black fatherhood. Freelon and Gunn, whose father, architect Phil Freelon, passed away last year, and Gunn, who lost his father, Henry Brogan, even more recently, rap about the joys of spending individual time with their daughter. The indie caught up with Freelon to discuss the making of DAD, fatherhood, familial legacies, and collaborating with other talented Durham artists. Question: what inspired the single and the project? When my dad got diagnosed with ALS and we started approaching the end of his journey in this realm, I spent a lot of time with him. And during that time when I was just kicking it with my dad, I'd be there for 4 or 6 hours. I started digging through these archives, partially to show him, like, remember this video? Remember this birthday party? Reminiscing with him. In the process of sharing those with my dad and rediscovering them, I began getting inspired to create. Also, when someone is close to you as your father transitions, you begin to really reflect a lot. You do a lot of deep diving emotionally. I started just thinking about fatherhood and what my legacy will be. My dad has left me many gifts, including the Durham Bulls Stadium and the Smithsonian's Museum of African American History and the many other things he built, but also the memories and the time and the energy that he shared nurturing me to become the man I am today. Just reflecting on fatherhood, it just went hand in hand with the creative process of digging through the crates of these digital archives. You and Joshua Gunn have walked similar creative and political paths. What was it like working with him? Well, Gunn is one of my favorite artists, and he has been since I was in high school. He was revered and feared among his peers around the local hip-hop scene, a sick battle rapper, and just kind of a young, hungry, talented brother. I've been admiring his craft as a lyricist for 16 years. Gunn was one of the few of my peers to have kids, so we shared that as well as hip-hop and, you know, running for mayor, and he ran for city council. We just have so much in common. In addition to being a dope children's album, I knew this would be a great opportunity to rally all the amazing musician parents. I produced or co-produced all but one of the beats on the album. And one of my biggest concerns with Gunn was, like, is he going to like the beat? I know from experience when you're asking an artist to collaborate with you, they really got to be feeling the music. When we got into the studio and he was like, oh, this is hot. I was like, ooh, a dope MC thinks my beat is hot. I was so flattered. There are a couple of recording reviews, but I will skip over them to get to the art and stage pages. And George Jen writes in Art, Paint and Destroy. Ben Bridges is a Vermeer with skinned knees and a Thrasher subscription in Back Burner. And this is appearing at the Craven Allen Gallery in Durham through Friday, July 10th. I'm nervous. We made it through the recession, but that was really difficult, really difficult. And I remember having the conscious thought, I never want to go through something like that again. It's May 30th, 11 weeks since COVID surfaced in the U.S., and John Craven Blodorn, co-owner of Craven Allen Gallery in downtown Durham, is weighing the current crisis against the 2008 financial meltdown. He's sitting in a small basement gallery surrounded by a series of phantasmagoric paintings by Ben Bridges, whose exhibit, Back Burner, squeezed in an opening reception just before the lockdown halted social gatherings. On May 11, Craven Allen became one of the first art galleries in the Triangle to reopen to the public. Bridges' show has been extended through July 10 to make up for lost time. That was the killer for me, Blodorn says. It was an exciting show that nobody saw. The world was starting to get really distracted right at the time of the opening, and now we're trying to salvage it. It's painfully apt that Bridges' 27 oil paintings on canvas depict something like purgatory, inhabited by cryptozoological creatures and carnivalesque objects, all of which are rendered somewhere between anatomical and abstract. Bridges' lowbrow imagery evolved out of a lifetime of skateboarding and the irreverent pictures that filled skate zines and videos in the 1980s. But he paints deftly, using old-world technique, patiently layering thin glazes to render pitch-dark shadows and teasing mysterious luminosity from those strata. It's a style the Dutch painters gifted to the language of art more than 300 years ago. The homage is clear, but Bridger's marks are intentionally crude, and his subjects are grotesque, in a gesture that defies that same history. The confluence between skate culture and Bridger's chosen medium is subtle, and all the more rewarding when revealed. A painting called East of Barstow refers to the last significant parcel of civilization before I-40 makes an agonizing desert run towards Los Angeles, the holy land of skateboarding. It depicts an odd configuration of objects that could have been dreamed up by a madman. Just beneath that, a smaller piece, Cervantes, reads like a close-up of the same image. Bridges repeats the composition but changes the scale and the details, resulting in a giddy moment of disorientation. The title is a reference to Don Quixote, which chronicles the adventures of a delusional knight-errant. Beneath it is Laughingstock, which presents a stage lined with unnameable creatures whose crustaceous shells are painstakingly striped, black and white, like jumpsuits on a mid-century chain gang. The paintings read as the elaborate doodles of a restless hand, giving the consideration reserved for a masterwork. They amount to a damn-it-all attitude, expressed with discipline and rigor, right in line with the spirit of skateboarding and the punk hardcore music that accompanies it. But beyond reference to his source material, Bridger's images are stubbornly cryptic. It's impossible to decipher what, if anything, is at stake in these paintings. With skateboarding, the bet is simple. You either stick the trick or fall down trying. The sport is inherently honest in that way. Art, however, is rife with strategies that allow an artist to shield deficiencies or hedge the bet, and Bridger's leans hard on the evasive and enigmatic. And given the timing of this show, Bridger's unwillingness to be pinned down might be a good thing. His work satiates our reverence for acts of irreverence, setting the right tone as Craven Allen Gallery re-engages with a world wrought with new uncertainties and grief. You can catch the last days of Backburner during gallery hours as long as you're willing to practice social distancing and wear a mask, which the gallery will provide. Even with these new impediments to managing a safe public space, Blodorn remains optimistic. He says, "We are going to have to reinvent ourselves somehow, and we are going to have to find meaning. I'm still feeling it out, and I don't have any easy answers." The gallery's next exhibit is From Memory by landscape painter Sue Sneeden. There will be no physical opening reception, so Blodorn and his crew are working to create a virtual equivalent. Starting July 20, Sneeden's work will be available to view in person during gallery hours or online, along with a short film about Sneeden by Donna Campbell and Georgianne Eubanks. At some point, Craven Allen will host a Facebook Live event in an attempt to channel some of the energy typical of Sneeden's many past shows. "She's had probably 15 shows here," Blodorn says wistfully. "She has her band here every time. She does her own little events where she invites people after hours. It's this huge thing for her." He drifts into thought. "What's that going to be like?" he muses. "And I just don't know." And I think I can backtrack now to a music column by Sarah Edwards, who does review two new records. The first is by Josh Kimbrough, Slither, Soar, and Disappear. Her review: nearly every song on Josh Kimbrough's new instrumental guitar record, Slither, Soar, and Disappear, hones in on an evocative image of the natural world. There's Giant Leopard Moth and Morning Moon, Backyard Hawk, and Sunbathing Water Snake. Kimbrough is adept at the emotional close lens, and the specificity of these images make each song feel rich and suspended in amber. Kimbrough, whom you might know from Chapel Hill indie bands like Butterflies and Teardrop Canyon, wrote the album during scattered moments of quiet as a new parent. A radiant immersion in the present moment shines through. A fingerstyle guitarist and composer long associated with Trekkie Records, Kimbrough enlists Casey Tall, Jeff Crawford, Andrew Marlin, and Leah Gibson for instrumental backing on this album, the first under his own name, and they give it a textured, dynamic feel. Kimbrough has said that he learned to play music by studying Freddie King instrumentals, and that bluesy influence is apparent in his deft finger-picking. He stirs up lush flurries of notes as the songs weave between plaintive moments of isolated steel string and full-bodied instrumentation, double bass, flute, strings, mandolin, banjo, and drums. On Backyard Hawk, Rachel Keel's trilling flute creates a sense of soaring, while Kimbrough's patient, probing guitar brings the song back to earth. As with parenthood, he may be experiencing something big and awe-inspiring, but it's in his backyard, and he's there for it. So are we. And Sarah Edwards' second review, The Dead Tongues, Transmigration Blues. To transmigrate is to be reborn. As the singer-songwriter Ryan Gustafson was wrapping up Transmigration Blues last summer, he fell into a brief depressive slump that mirrored the album's themes. Completing the project had left a hole in him. Rebirth can't happen without a little death or grief. Transmigration Blues is Gustafson's fourth album as The Dead Tongues, and the first he's made since departing from the Triangle for a century-old cabin nestled in western North Carolina. Still, he has deep roots in the Piedmont, and the album features an illustrious host of local collaborators, including Molly Sarley, Amelia Meath, Alexandra Sauser-Monig, Josh Moore, and Alex Bingham, among others. In previous lives, Gustafson has been a hired hand, touring with the likes of Hiss, Golden Messenger, and Phil Cook. Like them, he knows how to parlay searching lyricism into revelatory Americana. And Transmigration Blues does that, to some degree, with the sun-scorched hymns that mark the end of a season of life and rhythms that fall somewhere between ruminative and rollicking. Capacious as Gustafson's ear for melody is, the instrumentation on Song Called Void and Road to Heaven is particularly beautiful, this is not an album that translates particularly well to the present moment. The concept of transmigration is conceptualized through songs about the regrets and romances of the open road, a theme that runs the risk of being unimaginative at best, self-reflective at worst. Gustafson isn't good at songs that mourn the end of things, but right now, what's most compelling is the creative birth that comes next. And now I'm going to inflict some excessive rustling of pages as I leaf through the Indie Week's annual Best of the Triangle Awards issue, a huge supplement inside here which has categories for just about everything you can think of, especially in terms of food and drink. And there are other categories of things, massage services and what have you, counseling. I'm hungry, so I'm going to talk about food and drink and talk about usually articles, of course, from the Triangle area. And they're not articles. They're just going to name the institutions that garner the first place in the award. And you can pick up the Indie Week or go online, and you'll be able to see not only the winners, but two or three runners-up in all of these categories. I will not read them. And just in terms of, to save a little bit of time, let's start with the best bakery. And in most of these cases, we're going to go Wake County, Durham County, and Orange County will have their own awards. So best bakery in Wake County is La Farm. And Durham County, the original, I'm sorry, I missed that. The best bakery in Orange Chatham County is Google Hoop Bake Shop. And in Durham County, why, it's Google Hoop Bake Shop again. They won in two different towns. Barbecue is the next one I rustled to. The original Q Shack gets Durham County's award. Orange Chatham, Hillsboro Barbecue. And in Wake County, we've seen them before, The Pit, authentic barbecue is in downtown Raleigh. How about breakfast? Elmo's Diner pulls it in for Durham County, and Elmo's Diner again in Orange Chatham. In Wake County, downtown City Market, Big Ed's pulls that in, and they're perennial winners, it seems to me. Well, it's getting towards lunchtime, and we should think about burgers. Where would you go in terms of the Indy Week's readers in Durham County? You'd go to Bull City Burger and Brewery. Al's Burger Shack should get some of your dollars in Orange County. And Char Grill, a chain in Raleigh and other towns like that, win the best burger. And let's go to, listen to me, Russell. How about Cheap Eats? Any bargain hunters? If you are in Durham County, the readers advise you to go to Alpaca, Peruvian Charcoal Chicken. And in Orange Chatham, Mediterranean Deli, Bakery and Catering. In Raleigh, it's Mommy Nora's Rotisserie Chicken. Now, let's go to, oh, I want to read about chocolate. And now, this is a triangle-wide award to Videri Chocolate Factory for the best chocolate in the triangle. How about the cupcakes? We're into sugar hits right now. Small Cakes of Durham wins that. For the best deli in the triangle, Neomond, Mediterranean, Raleigh. Interestingly, they didn't pull it in for the Mediterranean, but they did pull it in for a deli. Desserts. We have the Parlor in Durham County, Google Hoop Bake Shop in Orange Chatham, and Hayes Barton Cafe and Dessertery in, where is that? In Wake County. Oops. Oh, well, here are our friends of the Okefenokee Swamp Glee, Purlieu, and Fire Society. They're back to close us out for this broadcast of Indie Week. Read for our blind and print impaired listeners by John Feddersen. After this initial showing, you can rehear it as a podcast at ncreadingservice.org. So, John Feddersen wishes you all a pleasant week. So long, folks.